I really enjoyed looking at this scripture verse. It's not one that I've preached on often, a couple of times. And I've gone a little different direction than I'm going to go this morning. But it's an interesting passage. Interesting in large part for me, because the bulk of it is really not that great in terms of the central meaning of the gospel. And the first part, which is in a way just an introduction, just kind of a giveaway, is in many ways the most significant, and then the very last part as well. So, Jesus is invited by a leader of the Pharisees. Okay, and so I can't help myself. I'm going to say Jesus was a Pharisee. I used to wonder, you know, why if he didn't get along with these people, why was he around, and why are they dumb enough to invite the guy for dinner? You know, I mean, have major differences with folks. Why do you invite them over? Well, of course, the reason is that they're still part of a larger group. The Pharisees get such a bad rap, but in fact, they were reformers. They gave us the synagogue. They gave us the basic study of Torah as a major, and study of Scripture as a major part of worship, moving away from cultic sacrifice. They focused on God as Father. They talked about following Torah as the way to have fellowship with God. So, and they give us rabbis. So all of that, and historically, to state it accurately, Phariseeism is the beginning point for both rabbinic Judaism, modern Judaism, as well as Christianity. Kind of a big deal. Anyway, so leader of the Pharisees invites Jesus over, and he goes to share a Sabbath meal. It's important to recognize the sacredness of table fellowship. You know, there's a lot of talk. People talk about how families no longer eat together. And I guess they don't. I don't really know, to tell you the truth. But it is important, and it is a sacred time to be together around the meal, to break bread. It's not an accident that Jesus asks us to remember him in the breaking of the bread, in the sharing of the meal. And in fact, of course, when he talks about this, he says, do this as often as you drink it, as often as you drink the cup, as often as you share the bread, in remembrance of me. Every single meal is in remembrance of Jesus. Not just communion, but every single meal. Okay, then we get to the heart of it. The Sabbath piece is important because of the sacredness of the meal, but also because it sets the stage for what comes in verses 3 through 6, I guess it is. Or is it 2 through 6? I'm not sure. Anyway, it's the first or second verse at the top, and then it skips a part. So when the lectionary skips a piece, I always wonder, what do they skip? Why is that not in there? Well, what they skipped is a place where Jesus is healing on the Sabbath, and it gives a chance to talk about what is and isn't appropriate on the Sabbath. Once again, the footnote would have to be, there undoubtedly were people who did not think that it was appropriate to heal on the Sabbath, but in fact, it's not against the Torah. So that would be just a mistake. So if you back to our issue, Jesus was a Pharisee, he is correcting other Pharisees. In other words, he's correcting within the context of Judaism. It's not like this has to be a new thing. This is within the context of Judaism. He's reminding them this is acceptable. Okay. They were watching him closely. I love that. Luke's description. So, and why were they watching him? What were they doing? You know, that can be a good thing or a bad thing. One of the ways we learn, particularly when we're children, but hopefully our whole lives, we learn by observing people. You look at what somebody else does. Well, you know, so in a bad sense, there developed hundreds, probably thousands of kids who could not get up to swing a bat in a Little League game without going over and over the batting gloves. Why, thank you, Nomar Garciaparra. You know, love Nomar. I thought he was a great, great player. I was sorry when they traded him. He never got paid what he should have. But he was a marvelous, marvelous, marvelous athlete. We forget that at his peak, he was better than Derek Jeter. He just was better than Derek Jeter. Okay, but anyway, the batting gloves thing, you know, and there are kids all over the place doing that. Same thing with Carlton Fisk stepping out, you know. I understand he wanted to slow down the pitcher and so forth, but then there are kids everywhere stepping out. And Little League games, instead of taking, what, half an hour, they take 3.5 hours. Because you can't find the kids, you know, they're off doing other things in between. And people worry about how do you speed up Major League... I can't help myself. How do you speed up Major League Baseball? They're talking about a pitch clock. Okay, so my solution is this. Take away the penalty for the quick pitch. So right now, if the pitcher throws the ball and the batter isn't ready, they don't count it. No, they just say no, and they don't count it. I would say, take that away. Let the pitcher throw the ball as soon as he gets it, you know? Jim Kahn would have had a game over in, what, 45 minutes? Something like that. He was always doing it. Okay, so the point is that we learn by observation. And what we see, you know, people on TV were always smoking. It promoted smoking. Now, of course, nobody ever smokes on TV or almost anywhere else. And it makes a huge difference. We look at what our parents do, and we follow that. I was blessed early on to learn from two really great preachers and pastors. One was Ellis Johnson in Acton, who was my supervisor when I was an intern. And Ellis was a great preacher. He's retired. That's why I'm saying was. He was a great preacher. Just absolutely marvelous. And I can remember one afternoon I came into the church in Acton, and he was standing in the pulpit going over sermon. He was preaching his sermon to an empty sanctuary. And he did that every single day. And so, early in my career, I did that. And also, he wrote out the sermon, wrote out the whole thing, wrote out everything. And there's a lot to be said for that, because you can do different things when you're doing that. But for many, many years, I wrote out everything. Because the best preacher in the world wrote out everything. And therefore, you got to write out everything. And then, kind of by accident, I ended up preaching without notes, and I said, you know, I kind of like this. This is good. Maybe I can do this, and maybe it'll work. But I learned the best thing I learned from Ellis Johnson was the amount of time and effort you need to put into a sermon. People will say to me now, oh, I like it that you just get up and speak from the heart. Really? You think I don't go over this stuff? You think I just, you know, it's... No. No. Yeah, some of it is ad-libbed. I had not planned to talk about Nomar Garciaparra. I couldn't help myself. or about Carlton Fisk and so on. But the basics, the basics are laid out. Because, you know, if you care about something, you got to work at it. And Ellis Johnson showed me that. Bill Ziegler has so many gifts. Dick remembers Bill as I do. But one of his gifts, and it was a great gift, was that he understood every issue through human beings. Right? So I studied Christian social ethics. And I got a PhD in Christian social ethics. And I always understood the theory better than Bill did. But what Bill understood and would see intuitively was human beings. I used to say, show him a human being and he understands the issue. And that was always true. Show him an immigrant. Show him a person of color. Show him somebody, an LGBTQ person. Give him a human being, and Bill understood, a homeless person, and Bill understood the issue. Not only did he understand the issue, he could communicate the issue. He knew through that person. It was an intuitive kind of learning based on empathy. Empathy is not just an accident. It's something we learn. You know, do you see things through other people's eyes? Do you try to do that? Do you look at somebody and see what it is that they're facing? Often marvel, in fact, at people who don't do that. But it's a huge learning. And as a pastor, you know, it's absolutely vital. Absolutely vital. I once worked with a person who said to me, after a few weeks, we were talking about something and I was suggesting something, and they said to me, if you think you're going to teach me stuff, you're not. It's like, oh, that's an interesting perspective. You know, yes, I did think I was going to teach you stuff, and actually I thought you were going to teach me stuff. We learn from each other by observing what the other person is doing. But then there's another kind of observing. There's another kind of close watching, which is not the same at all. And that's the close watching, which expects the other person to make a mistake, which listens to the other person speaking only to find where that person is wrong. Now, some of that is critical thinking. That's good. But a lot of it prevents us from really hearing what people are saying. One of the things that shifted over the years for me as a pastor was that for the first easily 25, maybe more years, virtually every time somebody asked me a question, it was because they wanted to know what I thought and because they wanted to better understand something. So in other words, they're asking me about a Bible story or a theological idea or something because they're trying to understand it. And they want to know, what does my pastor think about this and how can this help me understand? Not because they're going to just end up agreeing with me, but because it's part of the whole business of what they're trying to learn about Christian faith, that they're thinking, here's a person, a pastor, who studied this stuff, presumably has thought about it, and what can he tell me? And then, a few years back, it shifted. And the first time it happened, it was a shock. Somebody asked me a question, and they weren't trying to learn something. They were asking to find out if I would give the right answer. And as I said, initially, I was astonished. I mean, that's just really weird. You know, it would be weird if, you know, if you're a physician and somebody asks you a question about medicine to see, you know, like it's a quiz, it's a little pop quiz about, do you know this? Or you're teaching history and somebody asks you a question about the Civil War. And it's not because they're trying to understand the Civil War, it's a little pop quiz to see, do you understand it? And I thought, that is just the weirdest thing. And that's in terms of how Christians interact with one another, that's been a growing kind of a thing. You know, are you giving the right answer? Are you on the right side of the issue? And, of course, we've done it for years and do it even more now with our politicians. And, yeah, we should look for what people say, and it does make a difference what people say, and all of that is important. But sometimes you have the sense that, you know, we're missing the big picture here. You know, there's a whole big thing being laid out, and we're focused on some small piece of it, which doesn't really matter at all. Now, Luke implies that the folks watching Jesus are watching not to learn, but to criticize. They're watching to be able to say, ah, see that? That's wrong. This guy's a bad guy. So for you and for me, part of the learning about this is, one, to recognize people watch us. People watch us all the time. And one hopes that as Christians, we would set a good example. You know the joke about the police officer pulls over the car with the fish thing on the back, you know, right? And the person in the car says, "Why did you pull me over?" And the police officer says, "You didn't actually break the law, but you were driving so rudely. I thought the car must have been stolen." Okay, maybe I didn't tell that well enough, but some of you got it right. There's another thing where somebody suggests that you ought to be able to hide that. If you've got a fish symbol on the back, you ought to have a way to hide it so that when you make space for the road rage. But we are always witnessing. We are always witnessing to our faith. And the question is, what are we saying? And then point two is, we can always learn from each other. We can always learn from observing other people. It's always possible for us to do things better. So then, Jesus, Luke says, he tells them a parable. He sees how they're all coming in, they're trying to take the best seats. That would be in church, that would be the seats at the back, right? We had a woman in Manchester who sat in the last row. She had a particular seat with she had some mobility issues, so we had double a seat with arms on it, so she could easily get up. So we were in a situation where we needed to put in more seats in the sanctuary. We added two rows beyond the last seats, two rows. But we didn't move her chair. We left her chair right where it was. She comes in the next Sunday. "You move my chair." I said, "No." Beryl was her name. I said, "No, Beryl, I did not move your chair. Your chair had been right exactly where it was. I just added two rows. You move my chair?" No. Seriously, if we had a row in the parking lot, she would have been there. So you'd be like, "Ah, that's my seat, right there in the back." All right, so we look for kind of our best seat place. Some of you might have seen on Facebook, Chelsea Humber told a great story about Matt, tragically died almost, I guess, 2 weeks ago tomorrow. And Matt was Chelsea's big brother. When Chelsea was a freshman at East Greenwich High School, and Matt was a senior, and Matt was a very popular senior, and sat at a table with the popular kids in the lunchroom. And Chelsea says she came into the lunchroom as a freshman, and she's looking around and thinking, where am I going to sit? And what am I going to do? And she's shy. And she thought, I'm going to run out and spend the whole lunchroom sitting in the girls' room. But while she's just about to break down in tears, Matt came over and took her to his table and told his friends, this is my sister, and, you know, made it clear, she's my beloved sister. And Chelsea said, you know, from that time forward, she always had a place. Place is important to us. So Jesus sees that they're trying to get the best places. People do that. And so it says he told them a parable. Well, it's fascinating to look at because it's not a parable at all. It's a teaching. Have you read it? He told them a parable, but then it's not told in the literary style of a parable at all. Now, there's a sense in which it's always a parable, but there's another sense in which the literary construct is not there for this one. So, it's one of those things then we latch on to because it's sort of like common sense. You know, don't take the best place. If you don't take the best place, then maybe your host will invite you to be in a better place, whereas if you're in the best place, then they tell you you have to make way for somebody else, and it's embarrassing. And, you know, this is just like how people can, it's practical common sense advice, which is to say, not the center of the gospel. I mean, the center of the gospel is stuff that calls us to be different than we were. That's uncommon sense. So it's not a great thing, and yet, of course, humility is a good thing. The idea that we are humble about who we are and what we've done and how we relate to others, I mean, that's a critical thing. Whether we do or we don't insist on being honored in a certain way. You all know, you met people who wear their titles all the time and are very offended if you don't use whatever it is title for them. And there's a sense in which, yeah, all of us can fall into that from time to time, but Jesus suggests that we need to see ourselves in a different way. I was thinking about this, and I thought about this in terms of the notion of privilege. Now, the notion of privilege, the idea that there's stuff we have in our lives which is just there, and we benefit from it. It's not that we're bad people because we've got it. It's just we benefit from it. Now, that's a very controversial thing with folks because there are some people who are just so set on the idea that I did it all by myself. That's a song, right? A kid's song. I did it all by myself, right? They're so set on the idea, and it's a toddler view of the world, let's face it. Which says, I did it all by myself. I achieved everything. Don't, if you tell me that somehow I've had this thing, you know, then it takes away from who I am. No. You just need to be realistic. Okay, so I am a cisgender, heterosexual, white, male, middle class pastor who comes from happy home. Now. And a nurturing home and all that, you know. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person, I hope. It does mean that there's stuff I have in the world which is helpful to me. It's a privilege. And I live in the United States of America, you know, which probably should have been the first thing about privilege. Because in global terms, that is absolutely huge. You know, and I was born a Red Sox fan, and all that stuff that you get that's just... Anyway, all that stuff that you didn't do anything about, it's so critical that we recognize what it is, that we see ourselves in that way and recognize that, no, it doesn't mean that people can't rise from whatever situation they're in. It means that we started out at a certain point. We started out at a certain point that's different from where other people started out. And one hopes that when we look at that, it's not so I can say, well, you know, I overcame more than you did. No, that's not the point. The point is to recognize that we didn't make ourselves. We didn't construct our own lives. We came into this world with stuff, and we continue to have that. All the time, we continue to have that. And some of it is reciprocal. Some of it is because, yeah, we've done good things. And hopefully, we, you know, you take what you have and you make more, you know, and you do something with your life. I mean, absolutely, that's absolutely wonderful. But to have the sense of humility, which says, I know that there's stuff that helps me. I was reading on one of our Methodist chat room sites, and this guy was offended because a woman had spoken about him being male as privilege. Well, duh, it is. I mean, it's not what it was 100 years ago, sadly, but you know, but it is. But it is, and not to acknowledge that is just to be plain stupid. You know, we have to see where we are in the world. Otherwise, we don't have a real sense of ourselves, and we don't have a real sense of everything else. And Jesus says, that's important. It's important to see yourself for who you are and to recognize the value of other people. And finally, last but not least, think about who you're inviting. Think about who you're inviting to have dinner. It ought not to be a transaction. Don't be going out to find people who can do you favors. Look for people with whom you can connect and for whom you can do something, not so that they will pay you back. That's such an important and significant lesson in the way we're called to live our lives. So often, when people meet others, networking, what is networking about? Okay, well, part of networking is mutual, but another part of it is, you're going to help me get ahead, you know? I'm going to talk to you because you're going to help me get ahead. Not because I'm interested in who you are, not because I care anything about you, your family. Maybe, you know, for all I care, you fall off the face of the earth. But what I need is for you to, you know, help me sell something, help me buy the right thing, get me a good deal, help me get into college. Right? Help me be seen with the right people in the right places. And Jesus says to all of that, no. Now, one of the great things about Jesus going to dinner, which happens more than once, he's the worst guest. He is just the worst guest ever. You know, it's like these people want to say, I invited you to dinner and this is the thanks I get. You know? You don't like my guest list. What is up with that? It's wonderful that he's always always talking to people, always and always, I think, in a good way, but who knows, helping people grow, helping people grow, and always challenging them. Which makes me think, so Jesus is a difficult guest, and it makes me think of the evangelical formula of inviting Jesus into your life. Let Jesus, I'm going to learn to do that. Let Jesus come into your life. In Maine, where nobody goes to church, as it turns out, they've got 8 billion radio stations that are doing that. There's guys that 24/7, let Jesus. So the thing is, when you ask Jesus to come into your life, he's going to change it. And if you're serious, if I'm serious about it, I'm going to find lots of things that I need to rethink, that I need to look at in new ways. He's not just going to come in and sit in the corner somewhere. It's, oh, Bill, such a nice job you're doing. No, but to say, you know, what is it that's going on with your life? And how can your life be different? And how are you thinking about other people? That, and if we're serious about it, of course, that's absolutely wonderful. So often, I think, okay, I'm being judgmental, so often, I think, when people look at that, they see this idea of Jesus coming into our lives as an end. Not a beginning, an end. We do that, and then everything is solved. There are no more problems, there are no more issues, we're all okay, it's all good. No. I mean, and we should know that. I mean, look at the stories of the great saints of the church. You know, Bonhoeffer. Let Jesus come into your life, you know, and then you're going to resist the Nazis, you're going to form the Confessing Church, you're going to, and ultimately, you know, come to a bad end. Albert Schweitzer. Did he have a great concert career in Europe? Was he a renowned surgeon in Europe? Did he do... No! Was he a biblical scholar at a famous... And he did all those things. At a famous university in Europe? No! He was in Africa. Dorothy Day. What did she... And the list... Martin Luther King. The list goes on and on and on of all these folks that we know. When they invited Jesus into their lives changed in ways that were huge in terms of what they accomplished, but also they confronted great difficulties. I mean, they stood up against things in the world. So Jesus is at once a great companion and at the same time a great challenge for us. And the lesson, I think, is that, you know, we are called to invite Jesus into our lives, not to make our lives easier, but to make our lives better and to challenge us to make the lives of others better as well. Let's be in a spirit of prayer. Gracious God, grant us strength and grace to invite the presence of Christ in our lives, to let that presence comfort us, sustain us, challenge us to be better than we have been, and challenge us to reshape the world as you want the world to be. In his name.